Hey, everybody. Hello, and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum.
And Matt Levine.
And we're talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts, welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. And we have a third host tonight, special guest host joining us, Brian DeYoung. Woo!
Hello.
Welcome to camp.
Thanks for joining us, Brian.
It's great to be here.
Brian, why are you at all qualified to talk about Alfred Hitchcock?
Why am I at all qualified to talk about Alfred Hitchcock? I am not qualified other than that I've seen about 40 of his films and maybe a dozen of them a dozen or more times. And The Birds, which is one of ours today, is in my top five favorite Hitchcock films and one I've probably seen about a dozen times.
Wow. A dozen times.
Probably. I mean, I first saw it in high school, and I bet I've revisited it once a year or so ever since then.
Ah, no, I'm impressed.
I'm glad you're impressed and you don't think it's, like, kind of sad.
No, I've been...
There are other movies out there, you know.
Look, I've seen far worse movies a dozen or more times.
Sure, yeah.
We're never ones to hate on, like, obsessive film fandom here, so you're in good company.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you.
I feel like the Hitchcock movie that I've seen the most is Rear Window. I've probably seen that about a dozen times as well, but Vertigo and The Birds are a close second and third, I think.
Ah. So those are your top three Hitchcock films?
They are, yeah. Pretty much in that order, Rear Window and then Vertigo and then The Birds. But, you know, there are lots of others that I've seen a lot. Psycho, of course, North by Northwest. It's hard to choose. So many good ones.
Okay. Well, we could talk way more about all that kind of stuff here in the next hour. But we want to thank you all for listening and for hanging out with us during this hour. Please rate and review wherever you listen. You can share this podcast with a friend. You can also send us listener comments any number of ways. Our email is campkaiju@gmail.com. You can find us on Instagram or just leave us a comment wherever you listen, and we'll be sure to feature that comment on the show. Matt, what is campkaijumoviereviews.com all about?
Oh, it's a fantastic website. What do we not have on campkaijumoviereviews.com? First of all, we have movie reviews. We go further in depth about both the movies, some of the movies that we talk about in the podcast, as well as many movies that we don't talk about in the podcast. On the website, you can also find our past episodes. You can learn more about me and Vincent and learn more about yourself. So check it out.
Everything you wanted to know about me and Matt Levine, you can find it there.
A little too much, maybe.
Also, special thank you to our patrons, Jason, Kelly, Peggy, and our anonymous patron. Thank you for your support. But, Matt, before I ask you what's coming up, I just have to shout out this Minnesota Web Fest, which I talked about with our last episode. We've been nominated for yet another category in the festival. This one, dare I say, is more prestigious. So the first one I talked about was our nomination for Best Podcast Concept, which is awesome and very grateful for that. This new nomination, we are one of four nominees for the best podcast in Minnesota.
Wow. What an honor.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you all for making it possible. And the Minnesota Web Fest is the first week of October in Duluth, Minnesota. So, yeah, shout out to the festival there.
And thanks to whoever nominated us. I don't really know how it all works, but I assume somebody nominated us. So that's great. That's awesome.
It could have just been an AI at this point. Who knows?
True. Even that's an honor in a way.
Some bot really, really likes you, Vincent.
Matt, what do we have coming up on Camp Kaiju?
So much good stuff. On our next episode, we're going to continue the nature attacks theme and talk about the movie Orca, the Killer Whale from 1977, which maybe is a Jaws ripoff or a classy Jaws imitation. That's debatable. So we'll be talking about that movie. Sort of coincidentally, after that is another nature attacks movie called Of Unknown Origin. I'm very excited for this movie. It's directed by George P. Cosmatos, who directed Tombstone, Leviathan from the 80s. He's a very good stylish horror director. That movie's basically it's about Peter Weller going to battle against a giant rat. So that's going to be fun to talk about. And then in a couple episodes, we'll be talking about the 1976 remake of King Kong.
Yeah, I'm bringing that one to the podcast. We were going to do it later in the year, but I figured I'd bump it up. King Kong, that's reach back into that well again. And it's a giant ape, giant gorilla. So, you know, kind of an animal run amok type deal.
True, yeah. But perhaps man is truly the animal that has run amok.
Well, we'll get into it with the birds. Maybe not the obvious monster movie that would pop up to a lot of people's lists, but how many other movies has Hitchcock made that could possibly be featured on this podcast?
I can't think of any.
No, I can't think of any. You need to broaden your definition of monster in order to do that.
Right. Sean Connery in Marnie. Or Hitchcock on the set of Marnie.
Yeah, indeed.
All right. Before we get into a plot synopsis, what is each of our personal histories with this film, The Birds?
I can start real quick. I've seen it many times, although not as many times as Brian. I actually remember this being a movie that I watched when I was very young, and it was kind of an instrumental movie. When I was like, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old, where I was like, oh, old movies are really great, and that kind of like led me down a path of loving film, hopefully for the rest of my life. And like I said before, it's my third favorite Hitchcock movie after Rear Window and Vertigo. There are some kind of like more left field or obscure ones that I really love, like Shadow of a Doubt. That would be up there as well. But yeah, I mean, he has so many great movies, of course. But yeah, The Birds, scary, complex. I've always loved it. It was fun to revisit it.
And my history, I saw it for the first time when I was in high school, like a bunch of nerdy friends and I got like three Hitchcock movies, all more or less in a row, Vertigo, Psycho, and The Birds. Skipping over North by Northwest, which is kind of an outlier, right? He put this like zany caper in the middle of these three very dark films. But we stayed up late into the night watching these three movies, which is probably about 7 hours total of runtime almost. You know, Vertigo is well over 2 hours. And I just absolutely loved The Birds, like the final scene where the lights go out and she goes into the attic, and then like the waking up and flailing. I just thought, you know, in a movie that was really kind of campy overall, that was a moment that was really like believable and realistic. Like, how would I wake up from something like that? And it just really stuck with me forever. And then I just kind of have sort of branched out into other scenes in the movie and just have found it to be way deeper than all of that camp on the surface would suggest.
This is a movie I should probably watch a dozen times in my life. It's like one of those movies that just like through cultural osmosis, I've always been aware of. I think I've only properly watched it once before, but even then, that was years ago, and I didn't remember anything except the really shocking moments, like the man whose eyes have been pecked out. Oh. So, anyways, the other night I watched it properly again. Since in a while, and yeah, I found the tone very interesting coming at it with fresh eyes. I was like, what is this movie? But like, I trust Hitchcock as a director. So like, I'm like, nothing's unintentional, but his intentional choices are so nothing short of just interesting to think about. Even if they don't like work for me, I'm just fascinated by them.
Vincent, I'm sorry if you already said this, but what are your favorite Hitchcock movies?
The first three that come to my mind are Notorious, The Man Who Knew Too Much, the first one. And I'm trying to go in like his chronological order. So like his standout British ones, like The 39 Steps, but The Lady Vanishes.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
I adore that movie. It is so fun. But then also, like, as you go through these movies and you see something like Foreign Correspondent, which is good, but once you've seen North by Northwest, you're like, oh, you start to see repeated stories and plot devices in his movies, which isn't a bad thing. Nobody had video rental at the time, so it's not like that would still be fresh in people's minds when they watch North by Northwest and they're like, oh, you did that in Foreign Correspondent.
Well, and Foreign Correspondent is basically like the 39 Steps plus propaganda trying to get the United States to enter the war.
Right.
Right. So like it was a very specific purpose to that film.
Yeah. 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 But then like the whole set piece of in Foreign Correspondent. Oh, is it Foreign Correspondent?
With the airplane?
No, I like Foreign Correspondent. What am I thinking? The Statue of Liberty.
Oh, Saboteur.
Saboteur. Yep. Yep. That one, I was like, this is North by Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Good correction. Thank you.
North by Northwest is like as good as you can possibly make that sort of like escapist popcorn entertainment, like Man on the Run movie. Like, you know, I kind of feel like movies like Saboteur were just leading up to North by Northwest, and then he perfected it in that movie, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But I would also say Hitchcock is my favorite example of an auteur where, like, familiar plot devices and, like, aesthetic devices, to me, it kind of becomes, like, an artist riffing on their favorite themes, and I really love it. Like, to me, I don't, like, get tired of it, and it doesn't seem, like, self-plagiarizing or whatever. Like, you know, I think it's kind of like thrilling to watch him like revisit these ideas over and over again.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the reasons I like The Birds so much is that he starts it off like it's going to be one of his kind of zany movies. And it's like there's this romantic comedy element and it's a little bit like an old Audrey or Catherine Hepburn, like Cary Grant, like sort of slapsticky kind of thing. And then it's not funny at all. Because, like, it's just absolutely horrifying, right? And so I think a lot of the campy elements are kind of intentional because he wants it to be funny because then the shocking things are more shocking.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree. I think it's kind of, not to go too deep into Hitchcock, and then we'll talk more about him, but I think it's also at a really interesting point in his career where after Psycho, and I think... when was Marnie? 64. So I think a year after The Birds. Like this period is such a weird kind of like fulcrum in his career where like before that, like things are kind of like classic era Hitchcock. And then everything after like Frenzy and Family Plot, The Trouble with Harry are like, you know, kind of like Hitchcock unleashed a little bit. Like, especially in Frenzy, you can like see him kind of like able to kind of like indulge in like graphic violence and graphic nudity and stuff like that. And that doesn't make like the movie automatically better. It's just interesting to see like these two different periods of his career.
Yeah. Although The Trouble with Harry was smack in the middle of all of these more serious 50s ones. So that's an interesting thing too. Yeah.
I get, yeah, maybe that doesn't count as well among his late period movies.
Well, but it's such an outlier of a movie too. Yeah.
Yeah.
One quick thing before we move on to our summary. So growing up in Orlando with Universal Studios in the 90s, in the early 2000s, they had a section of the theme park around Hitchcock, but because it's Universal Studios, they only had the rights to the Universal Pictures of his career, which is Psycho, on, I believe. So I have like very vivid images of scenes from Torn Curtain and Topaz and The Birds and Psycho, but I haven't really seen the bulk of those movies. So one day I'll get to them.
Don't see Torn Curtain. It's not worth it.
I do want to rewatch it, although I remember it being pretty bad. And Topaz, I didn't like all that much, but yeah. Frenzy is great. I love Frenzy.
Frenzy is great.
Yeah.
All right. Let's read this very brief synopsis. So we have a socialite, a notorious practical joker, Melanie Daniels, played by Tippi Hedren. She is in San Francisco shopping at a pet store when she meets Mitch Brenner, played by Rod Taylor. Mitch is looking to buy a pair of lovebirds for his young sister's birthday. He recognizes Melanie, but pretends to mistake her for an assistant.
Melanie then decides to get her own revenge slash a little bit of fun at Mitch's expense by buying the birds and driving up to the quiet coastal town of Bodega Bay, where Mitch spends his weekends with his sister and his mom. Shortly after she arrives, Melanie is attacked by a gull, but this is just the beginning of a series of attacks by an increasing number of birds.
What ensues is a day and night of fending off killer birds as they pick off town folks and wreak incidental havoc. That night, inside the Brenner house, with the family hunkered down and asleep, Melanie hears a faint rustling sound upstairs. She investigates alone, and upon opening the door is besieged by birds. Mitch saves her at the last second. In the morning light, however, it is clear Melanie has suffered severe shock as well as many injuries. During a quiet period, everyone gets in Mitch's car, and he drives them to safety as the birds look on. Or I should say, assumed safety.
Right, because while the ending is very ambiguous, I think it implies that the incident of attacking birds is not limited to Bodega Bay.
Do you know about the original ending that they storyboarded and everything?
Yes, but go on, tell us more.
Yeah, so the original ending was supposed to be that they drive out of Bodega Bay and you see the whole landscape is covered in birds. And then when they're driving into San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge is covered in birds, much like the Jungle Gym was covered in birds in the school scene. But apparently Hitchcock thought it was more impactful to just have it ambiguously suggested that the entire world was covered by birds rather than a landmark sort of thing. It's interesting that this film takes place in Northern California and there are like no landmarks ever seen.
I think part of that maybe is just because like Hitchcock hated shooting on locations so much. But also, I mean, I think it's intentional. Like this could kind of be taking place anywhere, you know.
And the original story takes place in Cornwall in the United Kingdom. I listened to a pretty good dramatic adaptation of that book over the summer. Very different, but the same in that birds inexplicably start turning on humanity. It's really good in its own way.
I really love the original short story by Daphne du Maurier. And I think, so she also wrote the story that the movie Don't Look Now is based on. And those two movies are like such a fascinating case study of how to do an adaptation, because Don't Look Now, the movie, is a surprisingly faithful adaptation of that story. And The Birds, of course, makes a lot of changes, but it does have the same general storyline. But, you know, I just think it's fascinating that like these two movies, Don't Look Now and The Birds, like approach her work, Daphne du Maurier's work, in such different ways, but they're both extremely powerful adaptations. And yeah, I don't know. I won't go into too much detail about Don't Look Now because that's not what we're talking about, but definitely read the stories and see that movie.
This is Hitchcock's second adaptation of hers, because Rebecca from 1940 is an adaptation of Daphne du Maurier, and a much more true to the source material adaptation than The Birds is, because he just basically jettisons everything other than a rural setting and birds attacking. Everything else is not in the Daphne du Maurier story.
Yeah. That's a good point about Rebecca. I'd forgotten that.
I love Rebecca too. That's up there.
Yeah, that's top 10 probably. Yeah.
So of course the film is directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Would you want, are you both of you want to give a brief some summation of why he is of note?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, he started working in the silent period in England, and like already from the start, like in movies like The Lodger, for example, we can see his sort of like handle on visual film style. I think he was inspired himself by Fritz Lang, Hitchcock was, but he kind of like pushed forward, you know, just the aesthetic of suspense even more, like to, you know, the in a way that like no filmmakers had really done up to that time, except for maybe Lang, I would say. And then, yeah, over the years, I think he kind of perfected visual storytelling. His like storyboarding is like immaculate. There are so many scenes in his movies that are pretty much perfectly made, where every shot, every sound design decision, every edit is like calibrated to be as like maximally impactful as possible. And in addition to that sort of amazing stylistic verve, you know, there's a lot going on beneath the surface too. I think there's a lot of psychoanalytical themes, a lot of Oedipal complexes, which we'll, you know, we'll talk about in The Birds a little bit. Yeah, I think he's few other filmmakers sort of wedded mainstream narrative entertainment with like thematic subtext as cleverly and viscerally as Hitchcock did. That's my brief summation, I guess.
That was great. Let's give you a Substack.
Gold star. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Of course, there's a dark side to Hitchcock's personality, but I'm sure we'll talk about that too. So we can move on.
Yeah, we should talk about that. Brian, I was going to ask you, are you able to elaborate on Bernard Herrmann?
Yeah. So Bernard Herrmann, one of, in my opinion, the greatest film composers of all time. He had this very long collaboration with Hitchcock during Hitchcock's like peak period. His most famous score is probably Psycho, but I would say his best score is Vertigo. Bernard Herrmann was very much influenced by like late romantic opera scoring, like Wagner. In fact, Vertigo basically rips off Tristan and Isolde like note for note in the love theme in Vertigo. And it's just like anyone who's got a few hours should like listen to the whole Vertigo score and then a bunch of Wagner, and it'll just be a very educational experience. He's a master of orchestration and of the use of the bass clarinet. Like the way he uses the bass clarinet in the remake of The Man Who Knew Too Much is amazing. But he didn't do any music for this film, which was interesting. It was the second to last movie that he did with Hitchcock. Marnie would be the last, but actually he was fired from Marnie and replaced because Hitchcock found his writing to be too old-fashioned, and they had a big fight about that. So effectively, this was the last film that Bernard Herrmann and Hitchcock did together, because it was the last one he was credited for. No, wait a minute. No. Sorry. Torn Curtain. He was fired from Torn Curtain. He still did Marnie. Sorry. I missed it. Yep. So second to last. So I find it really interesting that even like Matt, you were saying about all these things that were perfectly calibrated for maximum effect. That even like how they did the bird sounds was all so like they had a composer composing bird sounds for maximal effect. Like in that climactic scene where the power goes out, there's this shriek of birds right when the power goes out, and it's like so much more effective than just the power going out alone. And then you get this scene from below in complete silence, where everyone's lit from below and looking up. Just one of the most amazing scenes where birds become music. It's just so cool.
That's such a great way to put it. And I think they actually, I can't remember the names of the instruments, but they used a new kind of like electronic instruments, I think, with like playback loops and like echo effects and all that to like amplify the bird sound effects. And I think the less realistic it becomes, the more menacing and terrifying it is.
Yeah.
It was one of those movies where halfway through, it was only halfway through when it was brought to my attention that there was no music in the movie. And that happens every once in a while when the movie, everything that's happening visually is so arresting that I forget there's no music. But that doesn't mean that the sound isn't there and just as effective. Because, yeah, it's just playing with sound. And Herman would know how to do that more than anybody. The screenplay is by Evan Hunter, who's a novelist. He wrote The Blackboard Jungle. And he adapted this Daphne du Maurier story. He also screenwrote Marnie.
Can I mention something about that real quick? Brian, you mentioned that Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann had a falling out. So did Hitchcock and Evan Hunter.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of with Marnie. I knew he fired somebody, but go on. Yeah.
I think I'm remembering this right, that they kind of had a falling out because Evan Hunter thought that the themes of Marnie were misogynistic and had very much had an issue with the apparent condoning of the rape scene in that movie. Condoning is maybe too strong of a word, but in any case, they definitely had a disagreement about what that movie was conveying thematically. So yeah, Hitch and Evan Hunter, I'm pretty sure they had worked together before this too. I can't remember on what movies, but yeah, Marnie was definitely like the last straw in their collaboration. Well,
even in The Birds, they went back and forth on the screenplay a lot. I mean, Brian, you mentioned that alternate ending. I don't know the specifics of that ending, but Hitchcock cut a lot of Evan Hunter's original script anyways. I don't know. I'm seeing a pattern emerge here with Hitchcock arguing with people on these movies and having it fall out, including with Tippi Hedren.
And I just want to add, I think this actually was the first time that Hitchcock and Evan Hunter worked together. So I corrected myself.
So I looked it up because, you know, Google is a thing. And he did a few Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes in the late 50s. But The Birds is the only feature film. So
he also wrote under the pen name Ed McBain. He wrote, I think, a lot of mystery novels under that name. So he's well known for those books as well.
Interesting. Okay.
Let's talk about Tippi Hedren. Minnesota alert.
Oh.
Did you guys know she's from Minnesota?
I did.
Yeah.
New Ulm, right?
New Ulm. And she attended Minneapolis West High School before the family moved to California. West High School, I read, was torn down in the 80s. Hey, Tippi Hedren, Minnesota native.
And kind of the start of like a line of Hollywood royalty, right? The mother of Melanie Griffith and the grandmother of Dakota Johnson. So
yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, Marnie, sorry, not Marnie. The Birds was her film debut, but she had signed a 7-year contract with Hitchcock himself. So The Birds was the first creative endeavor there, followed by Marnie. But then things really went to shit with Marnie. But that's an understatement, right? He was accused of sexually harassing her, emotional mistreatment, which we could talk about in a little bit with the more of the production backstory and history. But she has a lot to say about her relationship with Hitchcock on various interviews and memoirs. All that I think is important to keep in context with our conversation.
Definitely.
All right. Who else was in this movie? Playing opposite her, her love interest is Rod Taylor as Mitch. And this is funny. He was the voice of Pongo in the animated 101 Dalmatians.
He might have been a better Pongo than he was Mitch. I don't know. his voice acting was pretty good.
Yeah. And his last film was Inglourious Basterds, which I also found interesting.
I forgot he was in that too.
Yeah. Jessica Tandy, the late great Jessica Tandy, plays Mitch's mother, Lydia. Yeah. She's a legend, not only on screen, but on the stage. Streetcar Named Desire. She won an Oscar for Driving Miss Daisy. She's great. Look her up.
And Minnesota connection. She was friends with Tyrone Guthrie of the Guthrie Theater. and she acted in some of the first seasons in Minneapolis.
Nope.
There you go.
Wow.
I'm gonna have a Minnesotan sound effect to play here when
Woo.
we call that when we call it out.
Just somebody saying "ope," is that going to be the sound effect?
It'll be something like that.
Nice.
Rounding out the main cast is Suzanne Pleshette as Annie Hayworth, and Veronica Cartwright as Kathy, who is the younger sister of Mitch. So, pretty small cast, actually. Like, obviously, there's a lot of actors in the film, but as far as the main ensemble goes, pretty tight knit. Just focusing on the family there predominantly. The film was released in March of 1963 in New York City. I did read, I don't know how much truth there is to this, but there was an initial showing at the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. Peter Bogdanovich wrote like a little review of that film. And this was long before his time as a director.
He's always been a huge Hitchcock, what would you call it, acolyte. So that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
And started his career as a film critic, I think, and conducted interviews with Orson Welles, Edmund, like Howard Hawks, I think, as well, John Ford, maybe. So, yeah, I mean, Bogdanovich is a fascinating film personality, and he educated himself just by watching all these great movies. I would love to read that review, though. That's awesome.
His Hitchcock impersonation is in on point. Like, do yourself a favor and look up Bogdanovich impersonating Hitchcock. You won't be disappointed.
Okay, I will do that. The movie followed Psycho, which was released 3 years earlier. So a little bit of a break there. Do you guys know anything about that? Why he took a break? I don't know if there is anything behind it.
Was it? I feel like it was somehow related to Marnie, actually. That wasn't he going to do Marnie first? And Grace Kelly was. I'm totally spitballing here. I might be wrong, but I know Grace Kelly was going to do Marnie, and then Prince Rainier of Monaco was like, no, royalty can't be a villain or a criminal or whatever in a film, and so she wouldn't do it. And so I think. Matt, am I remembering this correctly? He decided to do the birds first while he tried to recast Marnie.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure, did he try to have Grace Kelly for this movie too? Or he tried to have somebody for this movie that was unavailable?
Because Tippi Hedren, he just like saw her in a ad for something really random. I don't even remember, but it was like a local ad in Minnesota
Nope.
for something.
I think in that ad too, I read this. There's a moment where like somebody whistles at Tippi Hedren as she's walking down the street, and that happens in the very first scene of The Birds, and that's supposed to be like a shout out to that commercial, which is weird because presumably only maybe like, I don't know, a couple hundred people would have seen that commercial. So who would have even gotten the reference, you know?
I mean, maybe it was a national commercial. I don't remember, but yeah, that's really funny.
Okay. Well, there was one fun review I just wanted to read. In general, the reviews at the time were mixed to positive, I would say. But this is one from Richard L. Coe of the Washington Post. He called it gorgeous, good fun in the vein of Hitchcock's earlier black comedy, The Trouble with Harry. And he added, I haven't had this kind of merriment since King Kong toppled from the Empire State Building. So just have to call the monster movie connection there. The birds right up there in merriment with King Kong.
Merriment, yeah. That's the first word that comes to mind for me, too.
The most sinister kind of merriment you can possibly
Yeah,
have.
yeah.
Can I quote the negative review from Philip K. Scheuer of the Los Angeles Times?
Please.
This is kind of fascinating, I think. He wrote that Hitchcock was once widely quoted as saying he hated actors. Which, by the way, I'm just going to interject. That's not entirely true. He called actors cattle, but he only meant that he like, you could like physically manipulate them and like order them to move through the frame. Anyway, that's not part of the quote. Scheuer's quote is, Hitchcock was once widely quoted as saying he hated actors after his 1960 Psycho and now The Birds, and must be fairly obvious that he has extended his abhorrence to the whole human race. For reasons hardly justified either dramatically or aesthetically, the old master has become a master of the perverse. He has gone all out for shock's sake, and it's too bad. I at least agree with the part where he says that Hitchcock has become a master of the perverse. That's true. It was probably true a lot earlier than this movie, though, too.
Right. But because, and I'm just spitballing here, you know, in the 60s, just culturally, we see a greater willingness to lean into sexuality and violence. And of course, Hitchcock, he's like, oh, finally, I can graphically show what I've been having to work around very successfully beforehand.
Yeah, like he got away with it in Psycho, and so he's just gonna keep doing that now.
Yeah, and like the scene where Vincent, you alluded to this earlier, but where the first, I think it's the first corpse is discovered with the eyes packed out. It's still shocking 60 years later. You know, 60 in 1963, violence was more permitted and was like going more in that direction. But still, it's like very jarring. And like we already talked about how this movie starts in sort of like a farcical sort of like screwball way, which Hitchcock, you know, wanted to do. He stated that was his intention. And I think because of that beginning, when we do see that man with his eyes packed out, it's like truly, truly shocking.
Yeah. Well, and what's really interesting and I think very effective about that scene is, again, the sound that, like, when she's in the house, there's background noise. You hear, like, the guy working outside on his farm. You hear, like, birds chirping, things like that. And then you just hear, like, her, like, choked, struggling for breath, and, like, a scream won't even come out. And her footsteps. That's like all you hear once she's seen the eyes pecked out. And so I think that's just really like, yeah, the world just sort of goes completely silent and you're just in shock and all you're hearing is your own choked breath.
See, this is why I need to keep watching it because in hindsight, I'm like, oh, you're totally right. That is what was happening. And not that I didn't love that scene. It's very effective and frightening. But in hindsight, I'm like, oh, duh. I get it. Yeah.
There's also a visual trick during that scene where we see like a glimpse of the corpse with his eyes missing and like a long shot, and then it abruptly cuts to a medium shot and then an equally abrupt cut to a close-up of the man's face, which is the same trick that was used in Frankenstein, another camp kaiju connection. When we first see the monster, there's like a series of very rapidly edited together shots from different distances. It's really, really effective. It's very kind of jarring to see that.
Yeah. Obviously, the film has been critically reassessed through the decades. Numerous top 10 lists. Couple of shout outs here, Matt. What movie does this is Bodega Bay also used in? Another monster movie that you love. Pop
Oh,
quiz.
the fog.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. I just made that connection right now. Wow, thank you.
I was
I do.
watching. Sorry, I was watching the movie and I thought this bay, this location looks very familiar and I couldn't place it. And then I was like, then I do my reading. I was like, oh yeah, the fog.
Yeah. Well, John Carpenter, of course, another Hitchcock acolyte. And yeah, The Fog is my favorite movie by him, more so than Halloween or The Thing. I would say The Fog is the most beautiful horror movie ever made, which probably sounds a little over the top, but such a gorgeous movie. Light is the villain in that movie, you know? It's, I mean, speaking a little bit figuratively, it's so good. I love it.
Okay, well, we'll move on, but you bring the fog to a future episode of Camp Kaiju.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a sequel called The Birds 2, Land's End, a 1994 made for TV movie. Have you guys seen it?
No,
Nope.
I don't
You
want to
you
because I did a thing once where I saw like sequels to Psycho, which is one of my top five Hitchcock films. And Psycho 2 was like just bad, like 80s. They waited like 20 years to do these Psycho sequels, much like 20 years to do the Birds sequels. And they were just so bad. And I'm like, okay, I don't want to do that to myself and watch the Birds 2 and ruin the Birds 1
Yeah.
original. So.
I do kind of want to stick up for Psycho 3 a little bit, which I'm pretty sure was directed by Anthony Perkins, and seems like a weird attempt to like mix the original Psycho with like an 80s slasher movie,
Yeah.
with like, you know, partying kids being picked off one by one and everything.
Yeah, yes, exactly. It's like Mother meets Jason kind of
Yeah,
thing.
totally. Yeah, it's a weird mashup. I kind of like it, but yeah, not as good as Psycho, of course.
Ooh, I want to watch all these movies. I'm always morbidly curious about sequels to movies that should not have sequels.
Yeah.
And one more fun thing before we get into our themes and our sponsor break. There is a Burge Barbie doll.
Is it still available? It was off the market for a while.
I found it on eBay for
Okay.
$400 nearly.
Okay, so it probably is off the market then.
It's of Melanie and she's got birds around her.
And she's wearing the green suit, of course.
That green suit designed by Edith Head is the only costume that Tippi Hedren wears through the entire film. So that's certainly a defining characteristic of her character.
Except a nightgown for like 40 seconds. That nightgown she got at that general store.
True. Good point. Yeah.
And I have to shout out the fur coat she wears, doing rowing boats, driving cars, fat. Like, I mean, just fabulous in that fur coat.
Early 60s glamour. So yeah, that's amazing.
And high heels.
Yeah. I guess on that subject, I feel like we should return to Tippi Hedren very briefly because, it was a tough working relationship, of course, between her and Hitchcock, and she was, resisting his sexual advances. Like it was perhaps more pronounced, definitely more pronounced during the making of Marnie, but it was happening during the making of this movie as well. And the stories or like the lore or whatever, and Hedren has said as much, is that Hitchcock would kind of torture her on set a little bit by like forcing her to like do numerous retakes of like the same scenes, including like that scene where she's just assaulted by countless birds in that upper like upstairs bedroom towards the end. So yeah, I mean it definitely was like an unhealthy working relationship from a very unstable man whose instability led to a lot of great movies, but certainly also was not easy to work with, certainly for like many of the actresses that he collaborated with throughout his career.
I was watching, I mean, she just, I mean, she only, I forget when she died, but not
Is it
too,
veteran? She's
yeah.
still alive.
Is she?
Yeah, she's like 95 or something, but
All
she, yeah,
right.
she's very much alive, I think. I'm gonna look it up right now.
Okay. I hope she's alive.
She's alive. Yeah.
Yay!
There
93 years old.
you go.
But no, I was just saying, like she's talked about this so many times over the years, and I haven't done an extensive research into this, but I did watch one interview from not too long ago, and she calls in the same interview, she says, quote, that he that Hitchcock was evil and an obsessive man, and he did ruin her career after Marnie. But she also talks about how she's able to separate the man from his art and his contributions to cinema. I'm not making a comment on that at all. I'm just saying like that's what I heard, and I want to learn more about Tippi Hedren herself.
Well, and it's interesting. I think I know what interview you're referencing, and she doesn't say that sort of stuff in all of her interviews. It seems to me like she's kind of at war with herself as to, like, if he hadn't watched that soap commercial or whatever it was, she probably wouldn't have had a career at all. And she was in this classic film, and he also like ruined her life and messed her up for decades. And I just can't imagine just living for decades with all of those conflicting feelings and having all of that emotional and sounds like physical trauma to just fit into this whole web of a career that went south. You know, it, yeah. People, she's been criticized like, oh, she's all over the place with her story. She changes her like narrative or her opinion of Hitchcock in every single interview, and it's like, yeah, probably. Because
Like, who wouldn't do the same thing,
yeah, it's not static.
Right.
Very messy. Yeah, very messy.
Yeah.
we can keep talking about this, but we can. But before we get into that, Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. So, gentlemen, I want to hear what you guys think about themes with this movie. I wrote down a few things that I latched onto, but there's so much. So I want to give you the floor first.
What do you think, Matt?
So to me, I think the main theme of this movie is the relationship between parents and children. We see that constantly throughout the film. Like Melanie talks about, well, first of all, she seems to have sort of an unhealthily close relationship with her rich father, who seems to spoil her every chance that he gets. She definitely lives a life of luxury. She's a socialite. Her father is a rich kind of newspaper publisher. And she, at one point in the movie, talks about how her mother left when she was only 11 years old. So she, you know, hated her mom when she was around, Melanie Daniels did. And, you know, so there's that side of her story and her personality. And then with Mitch, it's arguably even kind of a little bit more twisted. His father died a couple years ago, and his mom, played by Jessica Tandy, seems very, you know, still kind of not able to get over her husband's death, and kind of seems to be replacing her husband with Mitch. There is definitely an Oedipal complex kind of thing going on there. There's even a point in the movie after a bunch of birds kind of flock into the Brennan house where a dead bird like falls from the portrait of Mitch's father, which I think is like one of the clearest illustrations of this theme. And then we also get the sense that Melanie doesn't really have any interest in being a mother, doesn't seem to have much interest in being a wife, even though she kind of aggressively pursues Mitch to Bodega Bay. She's kind of, you know, like there are these tabloid stories of her like frolicking around in Rome and stuff like that. So it seems like some of the townspeople kind of distrust her and are suspicious of her because of her like non-domestic sort of attitude, you know? And even though we were just talking about how Hitchcock is like nobody would really consider him a feminist filmmaker, I do think the movie has a lot of sympathy for Melanie because, you know, she's kind of deemed not to be a natural woman because she doesn't want to be a mom. She doesn't want to settle down or anything like that. And I think we see like the guy who rents her the boat early in the movie, like look at her with this like look of suspicion and disdain. And then later in the film, there's another woman who is a mom, a mother of two kids, who says, "You're evil. Like all this started when you got here to Bodega Bay." So I think a lot of time in the movie is spent on this theme. Like the first bird attack doesn't happen until about 25 minutes in. And the second one happens like almost an hour in. I think it's like 45 or 50 minutes or something. And then most of the rest of the movie is about these weird kind of family dynamics in which we get the sense that nature is kind of turned upside down or not behaving the way that it should. And that's kind of like a parallel of the way that the birds are behaving. So it's there's a lot of complexity to this. I think it's a fascinating subtext. The last thing I'll say about it real quick, because I could go on and on and on about this. But there's a really fascinating scene where Mitch and Melanie are talking on the top of a hill. And there's a kid's birthday party, Kathy's birthday party, going on really close nearby. But the sound of kids kind of like laughing and playing cuts out very quickly in that conversation, as well as like any ambient sound effects, even though they're outside. And presumably they should be able to hear like the ocean waves and stuff like that. But all we can hear is Mitch and Melanie talking to each other about Melanie's sort of complex family dynamics and dysfunctions. It's just one of the most formally complex scenes in Hitchcock's career, which I know is saying a lot. And I think in general, this movie, there's so much going on beneath the surface about just, you know, just to sum it up. Yeah, like the way that parents and children like relate to each other and how those relationships can be extremely scarring over the years. That's a long answer to what I think is the main theme of this movie.
Yeah,
sorry, I was kind of rambling on there a little bit.
No, it was just like it was a fantastic way to put it all. I have nothing to add to that. That was perfect. Matt Levine, everybody. There's that moment at the end when Jessica Tandy is holding Tippi Hedren in the car, following. It's like right at the end, and I went, ah, she's got the mother figure that she had been longing for. That's all I can add because You know. Anyways, Brian, do you have anything else?
So I'm with Matt and everything, and I agree with you about the mother figure she didn't have, Vincent. You don't have to
Thank you.
Laugh yeah. at yourself about that. But Matt, I agree with you that it's more of a like feminist movie than you would think on the surface and expect perhaps from Hitchcock. Because at the beginning you have these three women, Suzanne Pleshette as Annie Hayworth, the school teacher, who I actually think does some of the best acting in the movie and is such a pivotal character in like turning this thing from a romantic comedy sort of thing with a domineering mother into something that's really quite emotionally intelligent. Like, she is the most obsessed with Mitch and the most self-aware. And so, like, she diagnoses herself, she diagnoses Lydia, she diagnoses it all super accurately. Like, we're all obsessed with this guy for different reasons. Isn't that messed up? And like all these bird attacks at the beginning of the film come like in the context of these interactions that these women have with Mitch. Like Tippi Hedren's on the boat and she like flirts with him and then this bird hits her. And then Annie Hayworth and Melanie are talking about all this stuff with Lydia and the bird crashes into the door while they're talking about Lydia's history and the way she's a mother. And then I agree that the birthday party scene is kind of where the movie turns, because Annie looks up at them talking enviously, like she's like suspicious and there's all this envy and jealousy, and then all the ambient sound comes back and the birds start attacking the kids. And so like I just think, and I think about this especially in the years since COVID and just some of the other like tragedies that have like stirred people out of complacency. Like we're all playing these narratives and these roles and the world appears unthreatening, even though we're all very threatening to ourselves and each other and doing all sorts of self-destructive things all the time. And then I think this is the reason it's one of my favorite Hitchcock films, is that I think it's actually a really hopeful film. Like Vertigo is super despairing, Psycho is probably even more despairing. Like you're never gonna escape your traps, they're always gonna be with you until you die or are killed. And this one is like, we live in a super threatening world that anything can go catastrophically wrong at any time, and when it does, like Jessica Tandy learns to move on and like accept love from someone other than her son. And Melanie Daniels, Tippi Hedren, learns to like sort of melt this frosty exterior that she, you know, protects herself with the hair and the clothes and the sort of standoffish attitude. Like at the end, this beautiful suit is finally torn to shreds and her hair is just everywhere, and that's like the final thing. Like it, all the facade is gone, the vulnerability is there, and that's when Jessica Tandy turns from, you know, this possessiveness to love. And so yeah, I think it's a very hopeful film in terms of like the power of human relationships to overcome anything, including like apocalyptic catastrophes. So
the one thing I'm going to add to that, because that was perfect and, you know, well said, Brian DeYoung, everybody, as they are driving away, and I've always noticed this when I watch the birds, is there is, it's the morning and the sun is peeking through the clouds. It is shot in a rather hopeful light, despite the ominous, you know, ostensible foreboding that's there. So I would add that to what you said.
It reminds me like The Road by Cormac McCarthy. I don't know if you've read the book. No. It's kind of that same idea. Like these people who love each other are surviving in a world that's gone crazy. Because that's what's holding them together.
Yeah, and even though the last shot of the birds is pretty nightmarish, I think it's pretty foreboding, you know. It certainly is more hopeful than the short story in which the main character kind of just is waiting to die. Like he has no hope whatsoever. Birds are taking over the world. He just smokes his cigarette and is waiting for the apocalypse to come. So definitely the movie is more hopeful than that, at least.
All right, guys, this is a great time. We can move into our good, the bad, and the campy, what we liked, what didn't work for us, what we found very campy or fun about the movie.
I think the good, like I mentioned, I love Suzanne Pleshette in this movie. I think she doesn't get enough attention for both how her character is written and how pivotal her role is in this movie, and the more restrained, in comparison to her castmates, the more restrained acting that she does. I mean, she's known for being a sitcom actor, and I think she's the best actor in this film. And I think a lot of the writing is really good. The dialogue is really good. If there's a lot of scenery chewing, they're saying good lines while they're chewing scenery. Visually, there's some stuff that's just amazing. Like a lot of the lighting in the final scene, in the final attack where the power goes out, they turn on the candles, or the lighting of the bird attack where they've ripped the hole in the attic. And a lot of, I mean, the famous scene with the jungle gym where she's smoking the cigarette and the audience sees the birds are gathering and she's completely oblivious. And then she turns around. And those kids, here too, music, there's not much music, but there's some diegetic music. Like the kids are singing that nursery rhyme. I don't even remember what it is. It's just creepy as hell. Something about kids singing is creepy, right?
I wrote the same thing. Yep, ditto to all that, man. Yeah, the suspense in this movie is really effective and built beat by beat. Other things so to save myself from repeating, I love the townspeople. I love the vibe in that diner, and you get like it reminded me of Tremors a lot, Matt. Just kind of, you have all these different characters who are all like, what's going on? What? No. But some are scared, and you just the water in the pots is just boiling underneath, and everyone's starting to amp it up a little bit. It was very fun. Also reminded me of the townspeople in Jaws. You know, it's like the same thing you see in subsequent monster disaster films. So yeah, the movie really sets a tone that would be emulated. Yeah, that's all I'll add for my good.
Well, you guys have already talked about my favorite scene in the film, which is the jungle gym scene, and like the moment when like w the camera like pans along with a crow, and like it like you know pans over to the jungle gym, and suddenly we see that it's just like teeming with birds, terrifying. So that's my favorite scene in the movie. My second favorite, which I think is kind of like lifting a couple cues from the shower scene in Psycho, is the bird attack scene in that upstairs bedroom that happens to Tippi Hedren at the end. There are like split second cuts. We see just like glimpses of like beaks and like wings and everything, and it seems a lot more violent than it is. You know, like in Psycho, audiences thought that like the shower scene was like so bloody and graphic, even though there's like maybe like a tiny little bit of fake blood in there. And I think this scene in the birds does a similar thing. You know, strictly through visual form, it convinces us that like what's happening is actually way more violent and terrifying than, you know, than like what's actually being portrayed. So those two scenes, the best parts of this movie.
All right, how about things that didn't work for us?
This is feels like heresy, but Jessica Tandy doesn't work for me.
Really?
I think it's just like suddenly you've got like Lady Macbeth in the middle of this. Like, what's this patrician lady, this Shakespearean person doing in this movie? It just doesn't work. Like, oh, if it was set in like old Connecticut or something, I feel like it would work. But this is supposed to be like a farming, agricultural community, and she just seems way too polished and to be in this. And Hitchcock didn't really direct actors, right? He just like put them in scenes, and what was more important to him was the composition of the scene than the acting. And so I feel like the acting is all over the place. There's like five different schools of acting going on at the same time. And sort of old Hollywood, new Hollywood too, right? So like there's this super melodramatic acting coming out of Jessica Tandy, and then sort of like more methody stuff coming out of Suzanne Pleshette. And they're all good actors. It's just so uneven. It's
Yeah.
almost like Jessica Tandy has a personality disorder or something. Maybe that's the point. Maybe she's supposed to be really patrician and defensive. I don't know.
I mean, you see her hard surface, melt during the course of the movie. So, but I agree with you. I didn't have problems with Jessica Tandy, but the performances by Hedren and Rod Taylor were not working for me. I just and it's not even like they're acting. I did find them really uninteresting, and I think part of that is also the characters themselves. And then you had actors themselves not bringing anything interesting to the role. So I was just kind of like, through that first hour of the film, I was like, ah, okay, I'm just like following these bozos around, and will they fall in love? I don't care. The lovebirds are more interesting to me right now. But then when it turned to more horror and suspense, yeah, for me, the movie takes off at that point.
Well, I mean, I do like Jessica Tandy and Tippi Hedren in this movie. I agree that there are a lot of different styles of acting, but I find more depth in these characters than I would have expected. I mean, like, I've seen this movie a lot, and like the first couple times that I've seen it, I was like, oh yeah, it's a Bird Attack movie. And by this point, I'm like, wow, there's actually a lot going on in these characters. But I will say Rod Taylor does not work for me in this movie. I think the depth that I find, especially in the Melanie Daniels character, is completely absent from the Mitch character. And he kind of just seems like a square, hero type. And he I just don't think they even attempted to like give him any personality at all. So to me, he's maybe the worst aspect of the movie.
Except that one scene, the party scene,
Yeah.
where she says to him really accusingly and angrily, like, you know what a mother's love is, all mad because she doesn't. And the way he replies, yes, I do, makes it clear that there's a lot of stuff he's not saying about what a mother's love means to him. Like, that's a really good read of that line by Rod Taylor, but that's an exception. I agree.
That's a good point, though. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, in a weird way, this is kind of like an echo of like the whole Norman Bates, like a boy's best friend and is his mother line. Like, that's one of the main ideas in this movie, I think. Although I mean, like that theme comes out, but like I still wish the character of Mitch was a little bit more interesting.
How about some campy stuff?
The woman who shouts evil, 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 and the bitch slap. It's so good. Oh, and her son, are the birds gonna eat us, mommy?
Yeah, I would agree. Like the townspeople in general, like Vincent, you mentioned that before. There's like the drunk guy who's like quoting the Bible, and then that like prim like British ornithologist lady who like does not seem to like fit into that community at all.
She's
I
only
think it's
there. Sorry, she's only there to tell us about birds.
yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think it's entertaining, but just yeah, it's maybe it is because of like Jaws and Tremors and Orca, which we'll talk about in the next episode, but like we've seen that kind of thing so many times,
In the very beginning, when Melanie is driving to Bodega Bay, she has the lovebirds in the front seat. And the birds are swaying with the curve of the road.
And the car, like the dash console with the gear shift, is so clearly made of like cardboard and velvet. It's just, or felt.
This is a I bet the comedy in this movie for me would sing more if I was watching it with a group of people. Because yeah, based on what we're talking about now, I want to watch it now and just laugh at it. Yeah, it's funny.
I'm glad you brought up the lovebirds. I was hoping somebody would.
And they wanted to take him with them, and me and Ellen were like, Don't take those lovebirds. They're part of the evil birds. You can't trust a bird in this world anymore.
Those lovebirds are going to be their downfall.
Yeah. Well, and I also, as a musician, it just the pianist, the scene where Melanie is supposedly playing Debussy on the piano, but clearly not even attempting to do anything remotely believable with the way she's moving her arms. Like, oh, it just bothers me so much. That's a very challenging piece. You don't just like sit there and noodle on it while you're talking to some 13-year-old girl about her birthday party.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, we could keep going on and on. But I think this is time for our final reviews. Matt, give us the lowdown.
All right. So the four ratings that we have here on Camp Kaiju, our highest rating is, it is a timeless classic and definitely stands the test of time. Our second rating, there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Our third rating is, it may be historically significant or just fun, but it does not stand the test of time. And our lowest, most scathing rating, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time.
Okay. I'll go first. I, upon initial viewing the other night as like fresh eyes, my determination was this has some antiquated moments. It stands the test of time, but the attempt, as I saw it, at broad comedy was not being performed well by the actors, and a lot of it was falling flat for me. But upon this discussion, I needed to be convinced this movie is going to bear repeated viewing and you're going to find something new every time. So I'm going to say it's a classic. It stands the test of time with its themes that may not be apparent on that first watch, but it's just because you're not looking for them, right? You just think, oh, it's a killer bird movie. But no, go back and everything is intentional. Everything means something.
Yeah, perfectly said. I'll just go real quick, and then Brian, you can have the last word if that works. But I agree with everything you said, Vincent. I think I love this movie even more than you did. It's like I said, my third favorite Hitchcock. It's just such a pleasure to see, like, such a, like, visually at least, such a perfectly made movie, in my opinion, that has so much more to offer the more times you return to it. To kind of echo what Vincent said, to me, it's an all-time classic. Definitely stands the test of time.
Yeah, I think it's a timeless classic that stands the test of time. I can forgive the first third of the movie, based on just all the things that you and Matt are talking about. Like even in the first third of the movie, where a lot of the acting falls flat, all of the aesthetic choices are intentional. Even all of the plot choices seem intentional. It's a really efficient film in a lot of ways. And yeah, no, a perfect film rarely exists. So I'm still going to say it's a timeless classic.
I would just say that, like, I think some movies are made more interesting when they're not perfect. And I think The Birds is a good example of that.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like Psycho. Like, Psycho is a perfect film, and then it falls apart in the last third. Like, to me, this is the inverse of that. Like, it's kind of rocky for the first third, and then it just gets better and better toward the end.
All right. Thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you heard, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit CampKaijuMovieReviews.com or Instagram for more monster movie content. We really can't thank you enough. Camp Kaiju is recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with theme music by Terrence Jackson and Mina's Mailbox music by Ben Cook Feltz. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio.
Who are you? What are you? Where did you come from? I think you're the cause of all this. I think you're evil! Evil!
say, oh, nice to meet the buyer real quick.